This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn.
This week on Meatin' 3, we celebrate Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with an episode about memory.
I've always read and sort of approached cookbooks for more than the recipes. To me, they are full of narrative content and narrative value.
So Malama Aina basically means to take care of the land. For us as Hawaiians, it's taking care of our older sibling.
But I do remember like definitely feeling like self-conscious about it, like being the only one who kind of wasn't eating a sandwich and like didn't have a bag of goldfish or Lunchables.
Listen to Meatin' 3 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Needs. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Philip Harper, the brewmaster and managing director of Kinoshita Shuzo in Kyoto, which has 880 years of history making wonderful sake. Philip has been working in the sake industry in Japan for the last 30 years. In 2007, he became the first non-Japanese brewmaster in Japan at Kinoshita Shuzo. Nowadays, there are more non-Japanese workers in the sake industry, but back then, it was a shockingly novel event. Philip has proven his remarkable talent, and his outstanding products have won many awards. And also, he has been inspiring the sake industry with the refreshing new ideas, like sake that is made to be drunk on the rocks. So today, we'll discuss how Philip ended up living in Japan and eventually becoming a brewmaster, and his unique style of sake making, his innovative sake making philosophy, and much, much more. But quickly, before we start, Japan Needs is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Needs. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Philip Harper. Hello, Philip. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Akiko. Thank you for having me.
Hey, so we have a lot to talk about. So first of all, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, I'm from the UK and I grew up in the country in Cornwall, which is way down in the southwest. So it was there was nothing particularly spectacular about our dinner table, I don't think. I think probably my mother was a fairly adventurous cook for her generation, so we had Indian food and Thai food and things on the table as well. And my father was a really keen gardener, so we always had lots of fresh fruit and vegetables to eat.
Mm.
And we had about like six or seven different kinds of fruit growing in the garden always. So there was always a competition with my sisters to get the best tasting strawberry or gooseberry or plum or whatever. And so thinking about it now, I kind of had an early training in thinking about the balance between sweetness and acidity, trying to find the right point between eating something that was too sour and something that was past its best.
Hey, wow, that's the best style of training. okay, and so I heard that you went to Oxford University, and
yeah,
after graduation in 1988, you went to Japan on the JET program,
yeah,
which is the government-sponsored program to invite young foreigners to Japan to teach English. So,
yeah, that's right.
How did you become interested in Japan in the first place and decided to apply for the JET program?
Well, to be honest, I didn't have any specific interest in Japan as such. I did literature and languages at university, so I was always interested in languages. My degree was in English and German literature and German language. So I spent a year living in what was then West Germany as part of my university course. I had no concrete ideas about careers that I wanted to do. I just knew that I wanted to live overseas again. So in my final year, I applied for a job in an East German university, and a university friend was in Japan on the JET program in the first year of that program. So I heard about that and heard that you could go to Japan and pay the rent by teaching English there. And so kind of just on a whim, really, I also applied for the job in Japan and got the phone call from Japan about 2 weeks before I got the phone call from East Germany. Otherwise, I would probably have been in East Germany when the Berlin Wall came down, and that would have been interesting too.
Wow. So this is really interesting about life, right? You never know what happens. It's very really exciting.
When I first came to Japan, I was sent to Osaka City. When I received the information about that, that was the first time I'd ever heard of Osaka. I had no idea where it was. I really knew nothing about Japan or Japanese culture or geography or food for that matter.
Obviously. And I read your past interview, and the first Japanese food you had was on the airplane to Tokyo. So
yeah, that's true.
That is very refreshingly new to Japan. And how did you become interested in Japanese sake, considering all those, you know, the paths you took to Japan?
Well, you know, I was always a fairly enthusiastic drinker of beer and wine and basically whatever came along. So before I came to Japan, I knew of the existence of sake. I think people in the UK now are much more familiar with Japanese culture than they were 30 years ago. But even then, I think people knew the name of this alcoholic drink in Japan called sake. And so I knew there was this drink made from rice. And just in the normal way of things, I was keen to drink that in the same way that I was always pretty much keen to drink anything else. But that was all the knowledge. I didn't know anything about it.
Okay, but what was like the moment? Like, wow, this is something special. Did you have that like a sake moment?
Well, when I first arrived, I mean, I started, you know, I drank whatever sake was there, and that was fine. And then I was working at public high schools, and in Japan, you commonly there are sort of drinking parties for colleagues and things, and there would always be sake at those things as well. And I drank that without complaint for the first few months and so on. And then I became friends with a Japanese man who worked in the school office. We started talking about music, and we kind of liked the same kinds of music. And the conversation got to sake, and he was saying, you know, that hot stuff that they serve at the school bashes, that's okay, but there's much better sake. And he took me out to drink in Osaka. And up until then, I thought that sake was something that you automatically drank hot. And he took me out, and we were served cold sake in wine glasses, which was a very refreshing experience at that time. I'd never heard of sake being drunk cold. And so, you know, the real enthusiasm for sake, the whole up until then, I was just a casual drinker, really. And that's when it really changed direction for me. Probably only a couple of months after I got to Japan.
Wow. I mean, you're lucky that you were in Osaka, because Osaka is known for amazing food culture, and I'm sure there's so many good sake too.
it was a great place to learn about food and drink, certainly.
Right. And after you taught English on the JET program, you decided to stay in Japan, right?
Yeah.
After 2 years. So why did you decide to stay in Japan?
Well, when I came to Japan, I didn't really have any concrete plans about what I was going to do. And I think probably if you'd asked me before I arrived, I would have told you that I expected to be here probably not less than 2 years and not more than five. But there was no real concrete plans. And then I got really, really hooked on sake. I was really interested in sake. After 2 years on the JET program, I mean, I really enjoyed my time on the JET program, and I really enjoyed the experience of teaching in Japanese high schools. But I'd never intended to be a teacher as a profession. So I was sort of 2 years felt like about enough of that. And I was already at that point thinking that it would be interesting if I could find some kind of sake-related work. And so when 2 years on the JET program was finished, I started working in a sake bar, but you can't get a visa to do that. So I got a visa to teach in a private language school in the day. So I do that in the days and then go and work in this in the sake bar in the evenings.
Wow. Okay. And so then eventually, I heard that you started your career in the sake industry at Umenoyado Brewery in Nara Prefecture in 1991. So how did you get a job at the sake brewery?
Well, this Japanese friend of mine, this guy from the school office, there was him and another friend of his. These two Japanese guys, they'd been in a blues band in junior high school together. And the three of us would go to concerts and go out drinking together and stuff. And this first friend, when I started, the year I started working in the sake bar, he gave up his job in the school office, which is a civil service job with guaranteed pensions and stuff. He gave that up to become a sake brewer in Umenoyado, which was one of our favorite breweries at that time. And so while I was working at the sake bar on days off and New Year, I would go out and hang out there. I thought I was helping out with work. I was probably just getting in the way. I saw what the work was like, and I was sort of really fascinated by the whole brewing process. And it was a very strange manpower system in those days. It was this old system of guilds, which had been in place for centuries in Japan, and which was kind of coming into in its twilight years then. And this friend of mine, I mean, he said, you should come and make sake as well instead of selling it. And at the beginning, I kind of laughed it off as a joke. But we always heard in those days about this sort of oncoming crisis in manpower in traditional breweries. And I found out pretty quickly that I wasn't very good at customer service either. And so a year later, I joined Umenoyado, where this friend of mine had joined a year before. And the other friend in this trio of the three of us who'd done all this drinking together, he also gave up his job and went to join a brewery in Shiga Prefecture. And so all three of us gave up our normal jobs and became sake brewers. And all of us have been brewing ever since, which is almost 30 years now.
What was the biggest challenge in working in the sake industry as a non-Japanese person back then? Because the industry used to have only Japanese male workers, and it must have been very challenging for you.
Yeah, well, so it was my third year in Japan, and I could get by in sort of normal conversational Japanese. But obviously, sake brewery Japanese is obviously a lot more specialized. So there were obviously lots of technical terms that had to be remembered. And my colleagues, almost all of them, they came from the Tajima region of Japan. Which is not that far from Osaka, but they had very strong accents. I really struggled with the regional accents all the time I worked with those guys. But the most exhausting thing about it, I mean, although obviously, you know, working in a foreign language can be pretty tiring. But I mean, I was already conversationally fluent after three years, so it wasn't so much the language stuff as just the level of physical labor. In those days, the brewers who were all usually farmers, they would work as a team, and they would leave their rice fields after the rice harvest finished in autumn, and then live in the brewery through the winter months and do the brewing, and then go home to their families in spring. So the whole system was set up without days off, because if you took days off, it just meant another day before you got back to see your family. And also because there were no days off in between, it meant a shorter season, which meant that the brewery owners had less salary to pay. So working every day from autumn to spring was like completely accepted part of brewery life in those days. And they were pretty long days. So a slow day would be starting at six o'clock in the morning. And sake brewing is all about microorganisms, and those guys move 24 hours a day. So work doesn't always necessarily stop at night either. So they were really long days and lots of really heavy physical labor. So I was like totally exhausted through the entire first winter, really. But as I say, I mean, although the language problems were obviously extreme for me because I was not a native Japanese speaker, but most of the burdens were not about being non-Japanese. They were just about the immense workload in traditional breweries in those days.
Right, but I would imagine you spent like 200 days together, almost like, you know, the sports team. I'm sure you built some good friendship, like camaraderie kind of closeness to each other, right?
Yeah, well, it was a very intense way of living. I mean, I actually rented a house not far from the brewery, so I didn't sleep at the brewery every day. Only when I was sort of on duty for the graveyard shift, but I was still eating three meals a day with my colleagues. And in the old system where everyone came from the same village in the country, they would all live in the brewery and not just eat three meals a day, but apart from the master brewer, everyone else would sleep in the same room as well. Wow. And so, you know, it was very intense. And if you got fractures in human relationships, if you got really problems that way, then things could go downhill really, really quickly. So there was a very Japanese thing to emphasize harmony amongst working groups. But I mean, it was as a matter of practical necessity. If people didn't manage that, then things could get ugly really quickly in the sort of intense setting of a traditional sake brewery. And of course, the guys I was working with, they were all the generation that went through the war. When they grew up, the great enemies were America and the UK, and they had learnt lots of stuff about what an evil country the UK is. some of it true and some of it not so true. But you can imagine they weren't all that pleased at the idea of having a foreign co-worker hoisted on them. They told me this sort of several months in, that they'd been really apprehensive about having a foreigner on the team. As you kind of said, it's a bit like a sports team, you know, and after eating three meals a day together for several months, they saw that this guy maybe made as much mistakes as the next person, but was willing to do what he could to share his part of the workload. And so it stopped mattering so much after a while. And I think it was probably pretty much of a culture shock for those guys from their generation, having a young British guy suddenly in their team. But after a while, it just stops, doesn't really matter anymore.
Right. Well, it sounds like that's the most intensive cultural training course possible.
Yeah, and I mean, a very traditional sort of style of Japanese culture as well, because, you know, these people were from a very rural background, from a very rural part of Japan. And so, like, food culture and stuff was like a very, very traditional Japanese home cooking and stuff. So in some ways, I've probably seen a kind of older version of Japan than a lot of Japanese people of my age ever have.
Right. And you're okay with the food that was served?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd never eaten Japanese food until I came here, but I've always enjoyed eating different foods. So there were Japanese foods that took a bit of getting used to, but I never really found it really unpleasant or difficult. And in those days, there was always a member of the brewing team would also be the cook. And there was a lady who came with the brewers and did all the cooking. So it was really good freshly cooked Japanese home cooking, and it was really good food. So I had no trouble with that at all.
So what did you learn at the Umenoyado Brewery?
Well, I mean, in my first year, it's a small brewery, so in small breweries you have to do bits and pieces of everything. But my main job in the first year was put in charge of rice polishing, which is the first step of sake brewing. And in my second year, I was put in charge of washing the rice and steaming the rice, which is the next stage. And I was put in charge of all the various stages of sake brewing. So I spent a couple of years making this weird stuff called koji, which is a very key part of the sake brewing system. I was put in charge of the making the yeast starter for a couple of years. And so I was in charge of every step of the brewing system, of the brewing process over the years, which sounds kind of logical and normal, but it turns out it's actually quite unusual. I don't think I've ever met another brewer who has been in charge of every stage of the brewing process. So I was lucky to be able to do that. And it's certainly, I think, it's been very important for my career since that I have been in charge of every stage of the process myself before.
Right. So you learned tremendously culturally and technically at the Umenoyado Brewery. So you got so lucky. All right. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into Philip's current job as a brewmaster at Kinoshita Sake Brewery. So please stay with us.
Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. That's ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat, and it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. That's ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, it's so good, I feel guilty eating it. Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Philip Harper, the brewmaster and managing director of Kinoshita Shizo, or Kinoshita Sake Brewery in Kyoto. He is the very first non-Japanese brewmaster in Japan. So after working at the Umenoyado Brewery for 10 years, that's a long time, and at some other breweries as well, you eventually joined Kinoshita Sake Brewery in Kyoto, where you work as a brewmaster now. So, by the way, our listeners may be familiar with the Tamagawa brand, which is Kinoshita Sake Brewery's flagship brand. Just delicious, delicious sake. So what is the history of Kinoshita Sake Brewery?
Well, the Kinoshita Brewery is owned by the Kinoshita family, and they've been in the same place in a little corner of Kyoto Prefecture, not Kyoto City, where everyone knows all the temples and gardens, but way up on the Japan Sea coast. And so this family has been there for 11 generations, and they've been making sake in the same place therefore seven of those generations. And so the brewery has been going for almost 180 years, and we still have some of the original buildings, which is quite important to some of what we do in our brewing work as well.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you joined Kinoshita Brewery as brewmaster in 2007. So
yes.
How did you become the brewmaster at Kinoshita Brewery? Because it must have been like an earthquake for the industry to have non-Japanese person at such a well-established brewery.
But at the brewery I worked before, I was in an Osaka brewery. And while I was there, I was promoted to master brewer. So I worked three seasons, I think, as a master brewer in this other brewery. When I finished working there, I was introduced to this brewery, the owner of the brewery, by a mutual acquaintance. And the brewery, they just lost their previous master brewer, who, an amazing man who he worked at the one brewery from the time he started as a brewer when he was 16 until he passed away in his late 60s from cancer, unfortunately, the year before I joined. And the owner was thinking about maybe closing the brewery because things in the sake industry here have been hard for so long, and he'd never worked with another master brewer. He mentioned this to this mutual acquaintance who said, this person I'd really like you to meet. And so he introduced me. So I think the owner was sort of really felt like he had his back to the wall, and he tried lots of stuff on his watch, but couldn't really see any way further doing business as usual. So when he talked to me and thought it would be interesting to have me make sake for him, I think one of the things that they had in mind was that business as usual was no longer working as a strategy. As you say, I mean, obviously from my point of view, I'm just a brewer, but from everyone else's point of view, I'm this weird foreigner doing this very Japanese thing. So I think it was probably quite a leap of courage for him to employ a non-Japanese to do the brewing for his brewery. But I think it was, you know, part of his analysis that things had gone as far as they could doing what he'd been doing before, and that trying radical new things was really the only sensible way forward.
Right. So do you think your style back then was pretty kind of traditional way, so that people are convinced that you can carry the future of the brewery?
Well, I mean, I'd worked already as a master brewer for 3 years, and I'd already been working as a professional brewer for about 15 or 16 years by that stage. So, and the Brewers Guild that I belong to also has a very strict qualification for master brewers, and my previous boss, he said that I should take this exam. So I took the exam. So I also have a piece of paper to say that I'm qualified as a master brewer. So, you know, there was good reason to think that I would be technically competent enough to do what was needed to do. And at that stage, I mean, we didn't really know what direction the brewery would be going in. The owner was thinking, you know, that there were existing products with existing customers, and he said we'll keep those as they are because we already have customers for these. But as far as everything else goes, you can do absolutely whatever you like, and just like bring in lots of new ideas because that's what we need. Mm. So we started with a whole bunch of new ideas, by and large, I think, I mean, we do brew some quite conventional sake, but the things that have done better have tended to be less conventional.
Right. Well, before we get into that, your unique sake, I understand that you passed Nambutoji Shikaku Senkoushiken, which is, very specific exam, and to be qualified as respected sake brewer. So, yeah, this is a great achievement, and congratulations.
Thank you.
And then So I didn't know that. I understand you worked at Daimon Suzo, right? Before you joined the Kinoshita. Right. But actually, on episode 214, Marcus Consolini, now it's the CEO of Daimon Brewery. So before you worked, Marcus joined Daimon Brewery before you.
No, the other way around. You left, right? I was there before him, yeah.
Right, so they kind of crossed. But yeah, so I didn't know that you were already the master brewer at the Daimon Sake Brewery, which is obviously very forward-minded sake brewery.
Yeah, the thing at Daimon San's place was I joined as a member of the brewing staff, and the master brewer at the time moved on, and so I kind of stepped in to fill that gap.
Right. Wow. So I think the sake industry has been very traditional, but the things started to happen that you are in the middle of that kind of like typhoon started to stir the whole industry. So that's amazing. With that, you probably, the industry could look a little differently right now. Okay, so so let's go back to discuss what types of sake do you make? You say like, you know, from the ranging from traditional to something very innovative. So can you just tell us what kind of sake you make?
Well, I mean, it's always a sort of difficult question to answer because, like, people say, what kind of sake is Tamagawa? We make a really wide range of different products at our brewery. One thing that we don't do is that in the last sort of 20 years or so, very fruity, flowery, sweeter sakes have become enormously popular. And a lot of the most famous sort of brands of the last 20 years or so have been made with the new generation of yeasts that make that style of brewing possible. And we don't do that kind of brewing. So we don't really have any very fruity, flowery kind of sakes. One thing that we do that is very unusual in the industry is that we make about 40% of all our sake without adding pure yeast cultures, with just ambient yeast living in the brewery, which when our brewery was started almost 200 years ago, that was where all sake was made. But now there are only a handful of breweries in Japan making any sake in that style. And that now accounts for about 40% of all our production. You're not really supposed to do it. It's supposed to be dangerous and unreliable, and so you're taught that it's not something that you really should do. But we've been doing it happily and successfully for 14 years at the brewery now, and we've never had a batch go wrong on us. So we're fortunate that the yeast living in our old buildings is a good collection of yeast or yeasts. We're not really sure. There's a whole bunch of different things working there probably. And also, you know, gives really strong, lively fermentation and really long lasting sake, which I think is really a characteristic of all of our sake. And I think a lot of times when people start to learn about sake, they're told that sake is very delicate, and that you have to keep it in the fridge, and you have to drink it quickly after you open the bottle. And those things just aren't true for Tamagawa sake, which is, as far as we can tell, lasts pretty much forever. And you can open a bottle and drink half of it and have it kicking around your kitchen at room temperature, and come back to it the next year and it will still be good to drink. So it's really durable, low maintenance sake.
Wow, that's interesting. Yes. So you said, you know, the wild yeast from your own Kura,
yes,
the brewery, with 200 years old. And I know how hard it is because I happened to work at the winery one time, and the winemaker, she was French, and she used wild yeast.
Right.
And then instead of throwing in, you know, easy to inoculate commercial yeast, it's like she was freaking out, literally like, oh, it's not starting. I don't know when it's going to start. So it's very challenging, and you can't rest until actually thinks that's going. So it must be very challenging, but I think
it's way more complicated.
Right. And then I know I heard a couple people told me about the style of your sake, and it's bold and you know, kind of like stable, robust flavor. Do you think that comes from the wild yeast?
I think it's easy to brew in those styles using the wild yeast. But I mean, even with the wild yeast, sake, we call it spontaneous fermentation. And within that series, I mean, we have very big, strongly flavored sakes, but we also have lighter things that we brew within those styles. We have like really sweet sake that we brew within that style, really dry sake. So you can really do pretty much you want anything you want to do with those yeasts. But I think the people who like our sake tend to like a very strong umami flavor in their sake, and we sell a lot of sake that in its undiluted state, which is called genshu, which gives you again an extra sort of burst of umami flavor from the high level of alcohol. Even the sakes that we make in the conventional way, where we use cultivated yeast, we tend to have sake with a very pronounced umami profile and lots of acids and amino acids. So they're big, really big meaty sakes, which are great for food and great for drinking at different temperatures.
A while ago, I tasted your red label Yamaha Genshu, which is Yamaha's old style, more kind of like a, you know, very personal, impossibly funkier way to make sake. And also Genshu is undiluted. So it's like, to me, it was like you said, it's umami and it's almost as weighty as food I had together. So it was so memorable and I loved the sake.
Thank you, sake. We sell a lot of that sake in the USA as well. It's a very extreme sake, but it's the most popular of all the things that we make. The most extreme sake is the most popular. So you can draw your own conclusions about what Tamagawa fans like from that.
Right. Now you mentioned earlier that, you know, the whole world started to be more towards floral, like sweeter sake. And I think it's partly good because it's more of a closer to the style of wine people enjoy globally, and also the Japanese people started to be drinking less sake, especially younger generation. So it's a good way to keep the pie bigger than that could have been. But the style of sake, like drier, kind of like more umami forward sake. So is that something that you try to maintain the style of Kinoshita Brewery, or just to think there's a value in that kind of style of sake?
Well, I mean, I think it kind of developed itself, because when I started working at the Kinoshita Brewery, we started with a whole bunch of different new ideas, as I've already mentioned, you were kind enough to mention the red label Yamaha, which is the sort of I suppose the most prominent of all the products that we make with these wild yeasts. But it's also one of our most successful products, and it's a very, very extreme sake. I'm quite flexible. I enjoy all kinds of sake, but the things that we made that people really enjoyed the most seem to have been the more extreme things. We have a few quieter products that we make, and people are often quite surprised when they come across them, because they think that Tamagawa is all these like big, bold, massive genshu sakes. And it's not all that we do, but there's no doubt that a lot of people really associate that with what we do.
Right. It's like a great actor. And the good actors change personality depending on what kind of character they act on. So really like that. And also, I think I read on your website, which I haven't tasted yet, but Tamagawa Junmai Ginjo Icebreaker.
Yeah.
Which is, it said, "Roku de umai." That's one of the tagline on the website. It's like, great, tastes great on the rocks. So what kind of sake is that? I've never imagined that could be possible for sake to be drunk on the rocks.
Well, we've had that product going for about 13, 14 years now. And I mean, the basic idea behind it is that we're coming into the rainy season in Japan now, whereas, you know, it's really hot and humid all the time. And if you drink a well-made sake over ice, it's just really nice and refreshing at this like hot, sweaty time of year. So we decided to make a summer product in that kind of style. And it doesn't work with any sake. I mean, a lot of sake, if you put it over ice, as you imagine, it goes all sort of wishy-washy and watery pretty quickly. But our sake doesn't. It when you put ice in it, it unlocks a whole bunch of different flavors. And you also get this like lovely cool air coming off the surface of the sake. And then as the ice melts, the temperature changes and the level of alcohol changes. So you get this like cascade of changing flavors and aromas in the glass. And it's like so much fun to drink. So we got a certain amount of criticism when we started doing it, because there are a whole bunch of purists out there who were annoyed with me, because apparently you're not really supposed to drink sake over ice. But we liked it, and there's no doubt a whole bunch of customers in Japan and overseas have really, really liked that. So that's been a very successful product for us, which has been kind of really important in some of the things that we wanted to do later on.
Hey, well, is it available in the US?
Yeah, it's already on the way. It should be arriving for sale any day now. It's a summer sake. We ship it about now when the rainy season starts in Japan, we ship it through the summer months, and then it goes away for another year until the following May.
Right. Well, just in time. Next week is the Memorial Day, so I can definitely use that.
I'm not sure if it's landed or not, but it's on the way, certainly.
Okay, I'll look into it. And so in general, do you call yourself sake as non-style, kind of like a flexible as it's needed? Because I think because of a specific history of your brewery and also maybe terroir, I'm just curious how those elements affect, how you think about making sake.
Well, I think if you look at the map of Japan and how the breakdown of sake styles and directions is, obviously you start talking about these sort of generalizations, and then you can spend the rest of your life talking about exceptions. But by and large, if you look at the sake that's made in the cold bits of Japan up north, they tend to be lighter flavored and lower in acidity. And then if you come further down our end of Japan, where, the summers are hotter and the winters aren't so cold, then you tend to get much bigger rice-driven, umami-flavored kinds of sakes. And so we are very much, in that sense, we're a typical Western Japan sake that is very, very rice flavored and very, very earthy and very rich flavored. Those broader regional directions in sake, I mean, I think they're very related to climate, because if you ferment at a lower temperature, then you get lower acid sake, which is exactly what you see in sake coming from colder regions. And if you have exactly the same sake and then age it at a high temperature and a low temperature, if you age it at higher temperatures, you get more color in the sake, you get more umami flavor. And again, that's exactly the kind of direction that you see in sort of classical Western Japan style sake. And very much ours is very much in that mold. So it is partly down to that kind of really nice organic climactic thing, which is a really broad background to where sake styles come from.
Right. Yeah, we shouldn't forget that sake is very, very terroir driven, very regional, highly microclimate. Right. Influenced beverage, very precious. And so you touched on already aging sake.
Yes.
Now, so I'm just curious, because you are now being known for making a lot of great aged sake. So, which is very unusual compared to the mass market, like the majority of the market. So what is aged sake, and why do you produce it?
Well, we make it because we think it tastes better. There always was aged sake in Japan, but they kind of lost it for about a century or so. But the first master brewer I ever worked for, his sake was like spectacular when you aged it. And even this is about almost 30 years ago now, and there was in those days it was even more unusual. But there was lots and lots of aged sake kicking around that brewery, the 3-year-old stuff and 5-year-old stuff and 7-year-old stuff. And I mean, like a lot of other people, when I first started drinking sake, I was taught that the younger the better. But when I carried on drinking, I found that a lot of the sake that I really thought was best to drink was not the young stuff, but the stuff that had been aged for a while. And so when I started at this brewery, I mean, I already knew this to be true of the sake that I made. And the owner also became pretty hooked on the old stuff after a few years of drinking it together. And so you know, we decided quite a while ago now. I mean, we started selling 3-year-old aged sake more than 10 years ago now, and we've been saving sake ever since. So you know, we've got a whole bunch of different things kicking around in our warehouses, getting better. We ship we have of the pasteurized products that we ship year round now. We have about 7 or 8 product lines which we don't ship until they've been aged for 3 or 4 years, and the bulk of them are aged totally at room temperature as well. So they're also very ecologically sound, because we don't spend a lot of money on electricity to keep the things cool. They're perfectly happy at room temperature.
So for legally speaking, for tax legislation, I think it's the aged sake is 3 years old or longer.
Yeah,
right?
it's not actually a legal definition, but I mean, there's a long-standing convention in the industry that if you want to talk about long-term aging, that you're talking about at least 3 years.
So when you drink aged sake, how do you drink it? It's always with savory food, or how do you?
In terms of serving temperature, it's actually very versatile. And I find the modern sakes, they're these very flowery, fruity ones. You have to drink them cold, pretty much. I think very few of them work well at room temperature or above. And we make a lot of our pasteurized sake. When it's young, it doesn't drink very well cold. But if you age sake for a long time, it's very hard to predict what temperature will be good. You can drink over a really wide range of temperatures with a lot of them. And in terms of food pairings, they are very good with savory foods, with some Western foods that Japanese sake can struggle with sometimes, like blue cheese and stuff. Those blue cheese is excellent with aged sake. Although aged sake comes in, you know, lots of different shapes and varieties as well. So it really does depend on the specific sake. But they're really interesting food sakes. You get a whole bunch of flavors and aromas unlocking that you only get with time, that it's impossible to get in younger sakes. And so each bottle of aged sake is kind of a journey in itself. And there was a time when I was taught, and I believed in this idea that of sake coming to a peak, and that you needed to drink sake at the peak. And we don't think that with Tamagawa sake. We don't actually find it goes downhill at all. So we think of aging more as kind of an ongoing journey with each bottle until you finish the final drop at the bottom.
So what happens in the bottle, because you know, it's pasteurized, so there's no active fermentation going anymore.
No.
So the existing amino acid breaks down more, and then more umami comes out. That's why you can pair something strong like blue cheese.
Right. You get a shift in the umami profile. You get a lot of smoky flavors coming out. When in younger sake, it often comes as kind of nutty flavors and woody flavor. So wine people, when they drink our sake, they often say these aromatics, these must come from the wood, right? But we don't age sake in wood, so all those aromatics which feel like they should come from oak or wood to wine people, they all come from the sake itself. And so you get all these like smoky flavors emerging. You get big changes in color. So sake starts off a very pale yellowy green color, and it gets over time it gets like browner. We have a sake made from a 300-year-old recipe, and if you age that for 15 years, it's basically soy sauce color. So,
wow.
As well as aromatics and flavors, you also get this like huge range of colors with aged sake, which is also really for us so much part of the fun.
Wow. You really got me really interested in aged sake. I really have to look into your website. Okay, and then, one question about, you know, there Japanese sake is increasingly popular outside of Japan, and
yes.
And we started to see more sake made outside of Japan. So, I mean, including the U.S. So what do you think of the sake made outside Japan?
Well, obviously, although there have been sake breweries outside Japan for a long time, I think the new breweries that we've seen started in the last 10 or 15 years or so, the smaller breweries, and I think a lot of those people are very strongly influenced by beer microbreweries, and by that whole the culture of craft beer, I think. So I think you see a lot of those influences there. And of course, in every country, the laws regarding brewing alcoholic production are different. So you're technically allowed to do things in other countries that you wouldn't be allowed to do in Japan, and vice versa. So there are sort of technical reasons why you can't get the same things. A lot of breweries overseas, because they come from craft beer backgrounds, I think they are interested in doing things that probably would seem very strange in a Japanese context. And one thing I find I'm always impressed by when I talk to these guys overseas is that the enormous technical problems, the challenges that they have to overcome to do the most basic things in brewing. I mean, if as a sake brewer in Japan, I mean in terms of the equipment you use and sort of basic technical solutions, the know-how is there, and it's very easy to find equipment for steaming rice or pressing sake or whatever. But these are really, really difficult problems for overseas breweries. So they have to overcome all these enormous technical challenges to sort of get to the starting level. So I have a great respect for all their efforts in this regard.
Right. I've seen many customized equipments made out of beer brewery equipment,
yeah,
or wine equipment. Yeah, they're genius. Okay. And so you are also the author of sake guidebooks and act as an educator when you go outside,
yes,
of Japan. So how do you predict the future of Japanese sake industry?
Well, I think you've already mentioned all these overseas breweries, and I mean this is obviously if you think of the way that the craft beer industry has like really changed the face of that market, and of the sort of really striking changes in the wine market that have happened in the last 15 or 20 years because of the conversation about natural wine and so on. I think we're going to see partly because of those movements overseas, and partly because the things have been so hard for so long in the Japanese sake industry that people are looking for new ways forward. But I think those ideas about craft beer and natural wine, I think we will see more of those ideas probably coming to the fore in the sake industry. But the sake obviously has its own history and its own sort of box of magic techniques, which not all of which translate well into a wine or beer terms. And so I think there's a sort of very strong, stable core of culture and of philosophy in Japanese sake brewing. And not all of that works very, very, very well if you try and sort of bring craft beers ideas to it or natural wine ideas to it. But I think there's no doubt that there are a lot of brewery people, a lot of producers, and a lot of customers are really interested in those things. So I think we will still see more new things coming in from that direction. I think another trend that you can see is that there is a kind of partly link in with those ideas as well. But I think there's an increased interest within the industry and from consumers about sort of time consuming traditional methods, which is essentially what we do so much of with spontaneous fermentation. And Yamaha and Kimoto, these old methods, which have a long history and are technically much more demanding. So we started doing our spontaneous fermentation project about 15 years ago now. And I hadn't really anticipated the interest I would get from wine people, because what we're doing fits absolutely perfectly with all the conversations that people are interested in natural wine. It's exactly the kind of thing that they are aiming to do. We've been doing really without thinking about it for the last 15 years now.
Right. I think the objective view to tradition, which the Japanese traditional industry tend to lack, not just sake industry, is being broken by someone, you know, analytical like you and other people who look at traditional elements like Koji. Koji is now being, getting attention by Kernel World to fermentation, like beer makers or any people. So I think hopefully, like you said, the sake industry's secrets is going to be more revealed and shared, and then it is going to eventually contribute to the sake industry prosperity for the near future, I hope. So what are your plans for the future? Are you planning to create new sake, or could be anything? What are your plans?
Well, I mean, as a company, our great project now is to age more and more sake and to bring aged sake more and more into the center of what we do. So that's the ongoing project. And the nice thing about doing that is that you don't have to come up with new product ideas, because every year you've got new vintages coming online. So it's always self-renewing. So there's never any lack of interesting new things coming online when you do this. So that professionally, I mean, that is the big thing. You mentioned before that I've written a couple of books before in English, and it's a long, long time since I've actually managed to write a book on English in sake, and a lot of the things I think now are completely the opposite of what I thought when I was first taught about sake. So I've been thinking for a while, it's time for me to put those thoughts in print. So I've been kind of working on that manuscript in the extra hours I have free because of the pandemic. Also, people for years have been after me to write a book in Japanese on sake. So I've got those. I've got these two manuscripts sort of on the go simultaneously now.
Do you know when it's going to come out?
No, I have no idea. But hopefully, in a couple of years, they'll both be out.
Okay, so then when did they come out? I hope you can return to Japan Eats and we can discuss your new books.
Yeah, certainly.
Right. And this is for the question for listeners who are not really into sake yet, but what is special about Japanese sake compared to other types of beverages to you personally?
Well, and I think the two great things about sake, one I think is very familiar to wine drinkers. Sake is like brilliant with food. My work brings me into contact with a lot of sommeliers overseas. And a lot of wine people have really become very interested in sake in recent years. And one of the reasons is that it's so good with food. And that you have in the wine world, you have a whole career, you have a whole profession of sommeliers whose job is to match wine with food. And that is because I think it's pretty difficult to do. If you know the food and the wine, then it can work. If you don't, then you can get some like real train wrecks with wine and food, and that really rarely happens with sake, if ever, I think. And the other thing, which is like I think really unique to sake, is that you get to drink it at so many different temperatures. So you already mentioned our product, which we suggest drinking on ice. But that same product also has a huge following of people who like to drink it really, really hot. And so, you know, you can drink sake really cold. You can drink it at room temperature. You can drink it warm. You can drink it really, really hot. And it does, it really becomes a different drink at different temperatures. And I think that is such a key part of the fun in drinking sake. And I mean, I love drinking wine and beer too, but if I keep on drinking them, after a while I get bored because I can't play with temperature with them in the same way that I'm used to doing with sake.
Right. Well, the other day I compared the same sake side by side with the regular temperature chilled and also slightly warm, and they have completely different flavor profiles.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's so much fun.
Right. Okay, so so we need to wrap up because it's getting late for your time, and also, so where can we find your updates online and social media?
Well, you can't because I don't do anything like that. So you'll just have to catch me when I go to America somewhere, or wait for a book, or all these online events which have been happening. People keep dragging me into those, so you can catch me online in those events, maybe, if you keep your head down. But I'm resolutely analog.
And your website, and where can we find your sake online? The Kinoshita Brewery's website?
Yeah, so we have a website for the Kinoshita Brewery, Tamagawa Sake. And I spent a long, hard time a few years ago turning it all into English. So there's an English version as well. And if you're in the USA, you can find a whole bunch of our sake there. We work in the USA and also in the UK, in fact, with World Sake Imports, who do an excellent job of explaining our funny sake to people overseas. So you look up with the World Sake Imports people and they'll be able to hook you up with Tamagawa Sake.
Okay, so the worldsakeimport.com.
That's right, yeah.
Right, okay. And also you can Google Kinoshita Brewery. And also, yes. Tamagawa. Your website is amazing. Okay. So thank you so much for joining us today, Philip. And I hope to see you when your book comes out.
Yes, thank you. And when the pandemic is calmed down in both places, then we'll be able to start going backwards and forwards and doing fun stuff again.
Right. And hopefully I'll see you in New York too.
Okay. So, thank you.
Thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikogatema.com. Japaneseats is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer today is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japaneseats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.